From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I literally was proud driving around. I thought, yeah, man, this is great. I've done great. And then to find out, you know, the plants were dying as I drove by was very dismaying.
As the proud owner of a Volkswagen diesel car, prolific documentarian Alex Gibney was horrified to learn that he'd been scammed. The supposedly environment-friendly vehicles were pollution machines. That inspired Gibney to direct the first entry in the new Netflix series, Dirty Money. Each episode examines a different example of financial corruption, from the Volkswagen emissions scandal to payday lending to the many failed business ventures of a certain reality TV host who now occupies the White House. Gibney talks about plotting out the making of Dirty Money and his recent foray into directing scripted television. But first on the news banter, Disney's Day of Listening and the fate of John Lasseter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my companion in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So this past week, Disney had a Day of Listening at Disney Animation Studios. That's what it was called. And this is a group with a bunch of human resources professionals to discuss workplace concerns, to facilitate a discussion of workplace concerns. And this comes, as you know, as John Lasseter, the head of Pixar and Disney Animation, has been put on what they are calling at Disney a sabbatical. This is a leave. This was associated with conduct that was not proper. He wrote a memo to staff expressing regret for these behaviors, which we have described as grabbing, kissing, making comments about physical attributes. This is according to an insider. And the question now is this really an attempt to take the temperature of the staff to see whether Lasseter could be brought back, as some think, or is it in fact a sort of way of trying to have a truth and reconciliation commission, and there's no world in which Lasseter comes back, as many animators think?
I think that's a good question. The interesting thing here is that this kind of Day of Listening is something that happened previously at Pixar in the Bay Area. And the result of that, as you reported this past week in Hollywood Reporter, was that many staff members had expressed concern about Lasseter's behavior in that Day of Listening, a fact that did not go over well when Lasseter was told about this. So it'll be interesting to see what comes of this Day of Listening at Disney Animation in Burbank, because will it turn into a complaint session about Lasseter's behavior? Will it turn into concerns about him returning to the company? Will it turn into a vote of support of people wanting him back? I think Disney's probably listening closely to those reactions to figure out how they're going to handle it if they are still waffling on whether to bring him back, which we don't know.
Yeah, I spoke to someone just recently who, an insider there, who said that there was a feeling that it's too public and that people will be afraid to speak up, and that was a concern. You know, Disney has known about these complaints about Lasseter, and he's certainly been known to drink very, very heavily at company events, and sometimes the behavior seems to be associated with that. Sometimes it's not at those events, but in the workplace, these allegations. So I think it's very awkward to bring him back. You know, we quoted an insider, a veteran, saying that, you know, for Disney's brand, which is this children's brand, squeaky clean, to bring somebody back when there have been complaints, as we are told, to HR, to the Human Resources Department, it creates a problem because, honestly, if there's one slip, it's very clear that Disney is on notice that this has been an ongoing problem. So they're taking a big chance, I think, if they do bring him back.
I agree with that. And, you know, what we've seen in these harassment situations is that typically when the people go on leave, they don't come back for the reasons that you just said. But this is an extraordinary situation in that he is the most important and influential person in the animation business by far. I mean, his track record of success at Pixar and Disney Animation and the fact that he is leading the two, you know, dominant with Illumination at Universal, the two dominant studios here, you know, this is the essential key man, a person that if you get rid of him, you have to be prepared for the consequences to, you know, your shareholders and the company and all the employees there.
Yeah, although I talked to a lot of animators who feel that, you know, they're talking about potential replacements both at Pixar and at Disney. And a lot of them feel that John Lasseter has positioned himself as the key man, but that, in fact, there is no key man and these things are team efforts. Now, you know, I would think that in many situations, one overarching vision is essential. But who knows? Maybe not in this case. And only time will tell. I'm going to pivot to Fox. Now, as you know, speaking of Disney, Fox is being sold, and most of it, to Disney, but not the Fox News Channel and not some other things, including the broadcast network. It does include the sale, the TV studio that makes a bunch of TV shows that have appeared on the Fox network. Modern Family is a show they make that appears on ABC, but they make Empire and Family Guy and all these animated things. There's a lot of stuff from that studio that is going to be bought by Disney. So that leaves Fox. The Murdochs, I should say. It gets confusing to call everything Fox. The Murdochs, we'll say. That leaves them with the broadcast network. And they have just paid a nice price for 5 years of Thursday night NFL games. Not all of them. Not the one on, like, Thanksgiving. That goes to NBC, I think, but still. But Thursday night games, not considered the pick of the crop, but obviously important enough that Fox was willing to plunk down, I don't know, $3 billion?
Yeah, it's a five-year deal for $3 billion. And you're right, this package of Thursday night games has sort of been this hot potato that has bounced around CBS, NBC, and it's not the premium games. And in fact, many have argued that it's been diluting the overall NFL product and causing the ratings overall to be diminished in recent years. But it still is 11 games per year of this premium sports product. And if you're the Murdochs and you're looking at the Fox Broadcast Network and how you're going to program this thing when you don't own a studio anymore and you see the ratings for these scripted projects on broadcast networks and they're not good, there is one reliable draw in broadcast television, and it is football. And that is probably not going away over the next 5 years. And, you know, that seems like an obvious bet for them.
I mean, I am hardly an expert on football games. I mean, I understand football, but I don't know much about sports network programming.
I thought you were a Redskins fan.
Well, I call it the Washington team now. But
oh, sorry. Yes.
But it seems to me that, you know, what we have here is a little bit of the oversaturation of this market. And watching football is some of the games aren't that good. And it sort of seems to me like a bad strategy, like when they stripped Who Wants to Be a Millionaire across five nights a week or however many it was, because it was a hit, and that killed it. And, you know, the ratings are maybe falling, not because players are kneeling, as our president would have you believe, but because there's just too much of it.
That could be the case. And I think there's a key fact here that suggests that's true. And it's that the NFL was willing to make a five-year deal with Fox. The past deals for Thursday Night Football have been a year, you know, splitting between NBC and CBS. And the NFL has purposely done that so that it could renegotiate each year because it perceived the value of its product to be going up and up and up. The fact that it's willing to do a five-year deal here suggests that perhaps they think this value has peaked or is going to be the same over the next 5 years, so they're willing to get into that kind of an arrangement.
Yes, so the upside is you watch football in real time and you don't fast forward through the commercials, but the downside is that the commercials are becoming gradually cheaper because there's, as I would argue, there's just too much football and too many mediocre marginal games being broadcast nationally. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new Netflix documentary series Dirty Money examines six stories of corporate greed and misconduct. Each hour-long entry is directed by a different filmmaker. Producer and documentarian Alex Gibney did the first episode on the Volkswagen emissions scandal, and it was personal. Gibney was outraged to learn in 2015 that his beloved clean diesel car had in fact been spewing harmful pollutants into the air. Gibney's car was one of at least 11 million that Volkswagen had fitted with devices designed to hide the car's dirty exhaust when they went through emissions tests. Gibney discovered that many top executives at Volkswagen knew about the massive fraud, despite their claims of ignorance. He was able to procure tape from several damning depositions, including one in which Stuart Johnson, former head of Volkswagen America's Engineering and Environmental Office, confirms that he had told the top man at Volkswagen America what had been going on.
Things were looking bad, you know, dire outcome. So Michael Horn called me. I told Mr. Horn, it looks like we've been cheating and we've been caught.
Alex Gibney has made a career of investigating secretive organizations, including the Catholic Church and WikiLeaks. His 2005 Oscar-nominated doc, Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, examined the collapse of the corrupt energy company. And full disclosure, I was a talking head in his film, Going Clear, about Scientology. When Gibney joined us from New York to talk about dirty money, he said the moment felt right for another look at corporate corruption.
The series came to be because it just seemed like it would be interesting, fun in a weird way, but also interesting to do a series about corporate crime, particularly at a moment when our current government seems intent on deregulating all things having to do with business. And so I thought it'd be an intriguing moment to look at corporate crime. And the idea was to do it as a kind of an omnibus series with a bunch of very talented and different directors. So it was the idea of the series that started first, kind of like a bunch of Enrons. And then the Volkswagen thing came later.
So you picked a number of projects. I mean, you have something about payday lending, something about Trump himself, something about VW. Were all of those the initial concept, or did you sort of say, sit down with a group of potential directors and say, which ones do you think are interesting for you to do, or how did you manage it?
A little bit of both. You know, Bethany McLean, who is a wonderful reporter, and she wrote the book, she co-wrote the book Smartest Guys in the Room.
About Enron, yeah.
About Enron. And when we used to go out on the PR tour for Enron, there was a phrase that came up over and over again. It's not about the numbers, it's about the people. And so I think with these stories, we were looking for intriguing human stories that really got at that human dimension of this perfidy. And at the same time, you know, trying to find broad themes and also what was interesting to the directors. So all of those things kind of moved in tandem until we were able to focus on what each would do. And, you know, they brought some to the table and we had some that we had to suggest and tried to pair them up. So it was a long grappling period. You know, we had about 13, 14 stories that we narrowed down to six.
And in your case, the Volkswagen one, did that come in kind of late in the game as an idea?
Kinda, though it was organic for me. I mean, it was, as you know from seeing the film, it was personal. You know, that's kind of what I decided to do. It just seemed to me interesting to do something that came out of my own personal experience. And that one really did infuriate me. And I thought both to look at my own, the way that I was duped, but also interesting to me, it was trying to get inside how it happened. Because, of course, you know, by the time this film had come out, the VW cheat had been exposed. But what hadn't really been got at was how it happened. What was the psychology of the people inside Volkswagen to make them cheat so vigorously? And then also, I felt that people were focusing on the cheat as if it was just, you know, somebody cheating at bridge. This had titanic implications, and we reckon that nitrogen oxide pollution causes about 10,000 premature deaths a year in Europe. So it's a story with enormous consequence.
So there is this moment where the great minds at Volkswagen decide to test the impact of nitrogen oxide on, initially they were thinking humans, and it ultimately ends up being animals. And I think there's a little bit of back and forth about who uncovered that when, but certainly it's part of your film. And there's footage that looks like, I mean, the footage looks as though it is shot for a documentary with close-ups and that sort of thing. How is that done?
Well, it was a recreation, and I'll tell you a little bit about what it was. I mean, at some point, VW, Daimler, Mercedes, and BMW concocted a kind of fake nonprofit called EUGT, and the idea was to do phony studies that would prove that diesel exhaust was really clean and almost good for you.
Right, like just you should have some every day, right.
It's sort of like the cigarette companies back in the day, you know. Cigarette mm-hmm. smoke was really good for you. It certainly wasn't damaging to the lungs. And Volkswagen, I think, was the partner of that tripartite group that really pushed it the furthest. And they decided to do a series of tests with a small laboratory in New Mexico. And first they thought, well, I know what we'll do. We'll put a person on a exercise bicycle in a small enclosed room and we'll pump diesel exhaust in there and see what happens to the person. And they brought that to the general counsel at Volkswagen USA And that general counsel, being wise to the fact that at the very least, Volkswagen was known as having been kickstarted by Hitler. So the idea that VW would be seen as gassing human beings.
Yes. Yeah. You immediately go there.
And as one of the employees in the film, who we got a deposition from him, said,
in retrospect, the optics aren't very good.
To put it mildly. Yeah.
Yes. But that didn't kill the idea, notably. They still pressed on and said, well, okay, okay, we get it. No human beings. But what about NHPs? Somebody said, well, what are NHPs? He said, non-human primates. Mm. And so ultimately they did the tests with monkeys. They literally put them in glass boxes and pumped in diesel exhaust to see what would be the effect. So it was such a gruesome idea that we decided to shoot a recreation based on some of the images that we were able to obtain of the experiment itself.
And the monkeys in your thing appear to be very distressed, but I'm hoping no monkeys were harmed in the making of this documentary.
They were not. We had a lot of adult supervision in terms of animal rights groups who made sure that the monkeys were very carefully treated. There was no gas used. It was water vapor. And we had to observe very strict regulations. And those were also monkeys who had been in films before. We really were very careful and cautious how the monkeys were treated.
So now I gather VW is saying, this is terrible. The German government seems to be saying they want to look into it, that they will never do anything like this. This is not okay. So is that partly an outgrowth of your film? Or where do you think that came from, the impetus?
Yes, no, absolutely. Jack Ewing, who's a wonderful reporter for the New York Times, had been working on that, on the story. So had we. We came out just a hair before Jack did. A piece in the International Business Times cited what we were doing. But anyway, we'd been working on it for some time, and we put it in the film. And so right about the same time, the pieces come out, and our film comes out on Netflix. And it has caused a lot of consternation. Needless to say, and rightly so. I mean, it's really appalling that this company would go to such lengths to try to prove a lie or to try to enforce a lie. That was the thing that I found so disturbing about it, you know, that they would go to such lengths to sell a lie.
You know, there have been some prosecutions in connection with this. Do you think more are in the works?
I don't know. I mean, one of the other things that we discover in the film and present in it is that certainly the head of Volkswagen of America knew about the cheat long before the cheat was revealed. It is true that VW has been fined a very large amount of money, and also a number of executives are going to jail for one person for 10 years. So it's not inconsequential, but I think that the investigations are ongoing because it's pretty clear to me that this was a policy, not only the monkey gassing policy, but also the policy to cheat and massively pollute, was a policy that was engineered from the top. Mm. And so those people really should be held accountable.
Well, that must be satisfying, like where you got rid of the car and then you got to smite them.
Well, it was satisfying that we got the story out. I mean, truth be told, I loved the car. And one of the things that enraged me so was that I had fallen for their advertising campaign, you know, which was, it drives like a sports car, gets great mileage, and it's clean. And so I literally was proud driving around. I thought, yeah, man, this is great. I've done great. And then to find out, you know, the plants were dying as I drove by was very dismaying.
So, I do
feel some sense of satisfaction.
If there's one thing investigative people hate, it's finding out that they've been played.
Indeed. Indeed, that's true.
So the one that I also saw that was very striking was Jesse Moss. This is about Scott Tucker, who is a payday lending king. He started this payday lending thing, and he parlayed that into becoming a race car driver with a collection of cars. And your director on that got this amazing access to Scott Tucker, who, I will say, does not come across too well. And I mean, as I was watching, I was thinking, do you think, I don't know how involved you were with each of these, and that's one of my questions. How involved were you with, you know, producing each of these? And did Scott Tucker think for any reason that he was not going to look like a jerk in this thing?
I mean, I think that everybody likes to have their own story told. And everybody likes to believe that they're a good guy in some fundamental way. And it's honestly one of the things that I find interesting about many of these stories. Is that even when people do the most appalling things, they find a way to justify it. And so it is amazing to me that Scott Tucker thought he was just a good businessman. In fact, at one point, Jesse Moss, the filmmaker, asks him,
"Do you think you're a moral person?"
"I'm a business person."
Enough said. And so, you know, I think in his view, it was just business. And it does testify, I think, to one of the themes that runs through these films, which is the idea that there is a bottom line. And the bottom line has nothing to do with morality. If you're making money, it's okay. And so it seems to be this idea that the end really does justify the means. If you're making money, fine. What's the big deal? And that is something that we wanted to upend with this series.
But I did wonder, did Jesse Moss tell Scott, you know, this will be your platform and it's going to be all good? Or do you have some kind of agreed upon set of approaches, like don't mislead the subject that it's going to be good when it may not be good?
I tell everybody, and I'm sure Jesse abided by it, you know, never lie. But, you know, at the same time, you want to encourage people to have their say as they would like to have it. And in that way, Scott Tucker talked and Jesse listened. And I think that's fine. I don't think in some ways that he even saw that what he was doing was immoral. And that, I think, is part of what makes that film so interesting.
Coming up after a short break, Alex Gibney talks about the transition from working on docs to a scripted project, the upcoming Hulu series on Al-Qaeda, The Looming Tower. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're talking to Alex Gibney, who produced the new Netflix documentary series, Dirty Money, and directed the first installment about the Volkswagen emissions scandal. Five other filmmakers tackled hour-long films on subjects including big pharma drug price gouging and a big bank's laundering of hundreds of millions of dollars for brutal Mexican drug cartels. The sixth and final chapter of Dirty Money, directed by Fisher Stevens, focuses on Donald Trump. Stevens examines Trump's many failed business ventures, from the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City to Trump University.
I think, you know, one of the brilliant things about Fisher's film, The Confidence Man, is that he focuses the Trump story just to business dealings. And you realize not only how appallingly immoral were many of his business dealings, but also what a bad businessman he was. He was a very smart celebrity, and he did make money, but he usually made money at the expense of others, and most of his businesses, per se, were utter abject failures. But he was able to present himself as a success, and by focusing it, it's kind of like concentrated orange juice. You can really taste it, and it's not a very
good flavor.
Tasting flavor, yeah. No.
I mean, you see the role also of the apprentice in selling yes. that version that Donald Trump constructed of himself as a brilliant businessman when the opposite was true.
Well, and you see the people who were producing The Apprentice
right.
talk about what a joke they thought the whole thing was.
We went a little further on the tongue-in-cheek aspect of Donald, mm-hmm. Thinking how funny is it to have this washed-up, you know, five-time bankruptcy guy who, you know, lives in a golden palace that other people are paying for. How funny is it that he is now the executive in charge of this big corporation?
They thought it was being played for yucks and for laughs. They didn't realize that ultimately the joke would be on all of us in this country.
A fake reality that they created around this guy who had a lot of failed businesses and couldn't get a loan from an American bank.
He just kept repeating himself over and over and over again.
As he does now, yeah.
As he does now, and that seems to be a winning strategy. Fake news, fake news, fake news, fake news. After a while, people believe it, even though he hasn't said anything to prove that it's fake news. It's a depressingly effective strategy.
So now you're also at Hulu. You've got Netflix and Hulu, and you've got Looming Tower, which is based on Lawrence Wright's book. You and he have now been through Going Clear and this one together in various forms. What's the state of play with that one?
So that's a dramatic series, a scripted series, based on Larry's book, The Looming Tower, which won a Pulitzer Prize. It's about the run-up to 9/11. And we focused it on the kind of the war or the conflict between the FBI and the CIA and the run-up to 9/11.
Yes, thank you for doing the part where I was supposed to say what I was talking about, Alex, because I didn't
know. No problem.
Go ahead.
It stars Jeff Daniels and Alec Baldwin and Peter Sarsgaard and Ren Schmidt, who actually appeared as the escort Angelina in my documentary, Client 9.
About Elliot Spitzer.
About Elliot Spitzer. And also the wonderful Tahar Rahim, who is the star of a wonderful French film called A Prophet. So it's great. And it's coming on Hulu, 10 episodes on February 28th.
And again, it's a scripted, so that's not something you've done a ton of.
Correct. It was fun. It was stretching a new muscle. And Larry and I, we had worked together on Scientology, on Going Clear. And also, we had done a film called My Trip to Al-Qaeda, based on Larry's one-man play, all about the writing of The Looming Tower. And so we had an idea about how to take his book, The Looming Tower, and put it into a kind of a limited series format. And we went in search of a showrunner, and we found Dan Futterman, who had written Capote and Foxcatcher. And then we took it to Hulu and kind of sketched out the course of a season, and Hulu said, go for it.
Did you go on set, and how involved again?
I directed the first episode and also kind of sketched out the broad parameters, but Danny and his writer's room scripted all the episodes, and another group of talented directors, you know, did the rest.
I mean, just give me like the difference when it's scripted versus doc. I mean, that is radically different, but I mean, did you feel like invigorated?
It is radically different. You know, working with the actors was a ball, and that was the part that everybody wondered, oh, how will you work with actors? I found that terrific, and I think actually documentarians have a certain advantage in terms of doing that, because instead of pushing actors, they tend to pull them or you know, let the actors bring what they're going to bring, and you listen to it, and maybe you redirect. Also, I was doing a lot of listening to the actors in general in terms of letting them help me help them. So, you know, I think my instincts as a documentarian were pretty good. Also, you tend to have a pretty good bullshit meter when you're a documentarian. So, you know, you look for stuff that doesn't feel right, doesn't feel realistic. You know, that was useful. I think the frustration for me in the process was the cutting period. I'm used to spending, you know, I'm a former editor. I'm used to spending a lot of time in the cutting room. As a director, you officially get 3 days, or is it 4 days, to do your cut. That I found frustrating. I'm usually, you know, used to a
Give me
long
more time.
Time kind of,
yeah.
Yes, exactly.
TV moves very fast, so I think.
It does.
Scripted. So having done this scripted thing, are you kind of like, that was super fun and I want more? Or, okay, that was super fun, but now I'm done.
That was super fun. I will do more, and I will also do many more docs. You know, I've always wanted to live in that world where you do both, because I think that they reinforce each other. The docs make the fiction better and vice versa. So I think it's good to do both. Over the years, it's tended to be more of a European thing. Now I think, you know, Americans are getting hipper to that idea.
Alex Gibney is the producer and one of the directors of Dirty Money, now on Netflix. Thank you for coming in.
Kim, always a pleasure.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.